Hello and welcome to the MIT Press Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Gondak. And today I'm speaking to Sherrian George, the author of Hate Spin, The Manufacture of Religious Offense and Its Threat to Democracy. Sherrian George is Associate Professor in the Department of Journalism at Hong Kong Baptist University. He's the author of Freedom from the Press, Journalism and State Power in Singapore, and other books. Sherrian George, thanks for taking time to talk to the MIT Press Podcast today.
My pleasure.
Your new book is called Hate Spin, The Manufacture of Religious Offense and Its Threat to Democracy. Most of us have heard of hate speech, but how does hate spin differ from it?
Well, I developed the concept of hate spin because that more familiar term, hate speech, I think fails to capture the kind of hate propaganda that I've been studying. Hate speech generally refers to the vilification of an identifiable group, say based on its religion, race, immigrant status, sexual orientation, and so on. It's done to incite harms, such as discrimination or violence against that group. And of course, that remains a huge problem around the world still. But there's another instrument that political entrepreneurs use that's related to, but I think quite distinct from, conventional hate speech. And this is where agitators whip up a reaction against some perceived insult. They manufacture a kind of righteous indignation against some book or video or a proposal to build a church or a mosque or a temple. And the goal is to marginalize their targets and gain publicity for their cause. So if you think of hate speech as the giving of harmful offense, then this other kind of expression could be described as the strategic taking of offense. Now, both are powerful instruments of identity politics. They're often used in parallel. And it's this two-pronged weapon that I term hate spin.
But as you also point out in the book, it seems that it's easier for governments and countries to legislate against those people who are instigating hate crimes as opposed to those who are instigating religious offense. Is that accurate to say?
Yes. Certainly, there's a good reason why we should distinguish between hateful actions and hateful speech. And of course, the American jurisprudence is the most liberal when it comes to allowing most forms of hate speech. And that has to do, of course, with the role of public discourse in democracy. So I agree that the strong distinction should be made in any democracy that cares about openness and free speech between offense, which is often subjective, and much more objective harms such as discrimination and, of course, incitement to violence.
So in this, your first answer, you talk about political entrepreneurs, and that is a term you use in the book. Could you explain how these political entrepreneurs can manufacture a political crisis out of a religious insult?
Yeah, I call them political entrepreneurs. You could also call them agents of hate, agitators, spin doctors, whatever. But you know, the key point is this, that I think in practically every large-scale sustained episode of righteous indignation that we come across, you'll find these middlemen playing a critical role. Too often when we come across these incidents of outrage, they're framed by the media as spontaneous eruptions of anger. This is especially the case with religious outrage. You know, how many times have we seen the media frame such events as a video or a book as sparking violence or triggering a riot? And these words suggest a process that is as inevitable or as natural as some chemical reaction or some law of physics. And I say that's wrong. I've quickly found out is, you know, when we dig into these events, yes, of course, there may be genuine hurt at the individual level, but its escalation into major sustained episodes of political contention, and argue, is invariably manufactured in a very deliberate and self-serving way by these entrepreneurs. And one of the most telltale signs is the fact that in almost every case you look at, The timing and the spatial distribution of these acts of outrage never quite match the appearance of the offending book or video. Often there's a time lag before the agitation starts. It often ends even though the cause of the offense still exists online and so on. And of course, there's a spatial distribution as well. You know, if indeed, say, Muslims can't help but lose their minds at some provocation, then why is it that in only certain localities they do? What's happening in the rest of the world? And these are all telltale signs that there's something far less spontaneous and natural going on here. And I would argue that, in the same way that we would follow the money when we want to expose financial corruption, I think journalists and other analysts can do a lot more to track the political interests at play here. And we need to peel back what on the surface may look like authentic expressions of public opinion and uncover the various agendas that lie beneath.
Now, I think it's fair to say the first part of your book, you're outlining and describing the terms that you're going to be using and analyzing just kind of, I want to say, generic cases of how this happened. But in the second half, you start getting into case studies and you pick India, Indonesia, and the United States, obviously three very large and pretty old democracies. Apart from the fact that they are large and they're democracies, were there other things that were going on within these countries that you found interesting enough to make case studies out of?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, we kind of spoil for choice, right? If you're looking for examples of hate spin in action. Well, these are the world's three largest democracies. If I had time to add one more, I guess the large case that is crying for attention would be what's happening in Europe right now. But the advantage of picking these three, other than the fact that they are big, is that they're all constituted as secular systems. They're based on the inclusive principle of what we might call civic nationalism. But all three have been pressured by religious nationalists, pushing for more exclusive identities. And what's interesting from a comparative point of view is that there are important differences in the way they deal with offense. I mean, most obviously, the US is the least reliant on legal prohibitions on speech, for example. And these differences make for interesting comparisons. I mean, as a set, the three countries also illustrate how right-wing religious intolerance is not monopolized by any one faith group. India is, of course, a Hindu-majority republic. The US is majority Christian. And Indonesia is the world's largest population of Muslims. So when we look at majoritarian right-wing groups in each of these countries, we see that there is really no limit to the human capacity to interpret any religion in a way that is self-serving, uncivil, and undemocratic.
I was really fascinated about all the things with Indonesia, since I knew it is the world's largest Muslim country, and I knew that it had a reputation for always, people always wonder, well, how can it be the largest Muslim country in the world, and yet seem not to really be bothered, or at least the press doesn't really portray it as a country that's bothered by a lot of religious extremism or Islamic radicalism. What's going on in Indonesia with regards to hate spin, particularly as you talk about in this book?
Yeah, I mean, Indonesia has in some ways rightly been held up as an example of a successful secular, tolerant republic. Some of that, though, is overstated. I mean, I think there's been far too much attention within both the Muslim world and more generally at terrorism as an indicator. So if you look at the success of regimes in combating terrorism, Indonesia has been reasonably successful. They've had a few incidents, but they've swiftly brought various terrorists to justice. And the government defines its success in dealing with intolerance and radicalism very much by how well it's doing on the terrorism front. But I argue in my book that, well, you know, there's a lot more going on in the world than just terrorism. In fact, I think it would be safe to claim that the number of lives actually affected by other forms of intolerance, discrimination, pogroms of various sorts, eviction from homes and so on, it's larger numbers than those actually affected by outright terror. And that's the case in Indonesia. I mean, yes, it's been reasonably successful in combating terrorism, but its record is not very good in terms of protecting certain religious minorities, mainly minorities within the Muslim population.
Let's talk about India. I found India also, all the three case studies are interesting, but it seemed to me that India, out of the three, had a situation in which the Prime Minister Modi and the BJP have built some electoral success on hate spin. So how does that affect them once they've gotten into power? Can a government continue to use those tactics once they're in power, or in a situation in India where there are societal powers pushing back against that they have to diminish using scapegoating minorities?
Well, yes, I mean, as you point out, Narendra Modi and the BJP is an alarming case of where the exponents of hate spin have actually managed to seize power, which is not the case in Indonesia, for example, and we hope won't be the case in the US. I mean, this being just, a few weeks before the elections there. The best case scenario, before the 2014 elections in India was indeed that perhaps once the BJP had used this kind of hate rhetoric to gain power, it would become more moderate. Unfortunately, that hasn't really been the case because in India, the BJP, after gaining power, seems to have, as a quid pro quo, handed over the education and cultural portfolios to some of the most extreme groups within the larger Hindu nationalist family. And as a result, policies to do with education as well as other cultural policies have become far more extreme than people had feared before the elections.
Now, in the chapter in the U.S., you touch briefly on the Donald Trump phenomenon, but I assume that you were probably writing the book at the beginning of the American primaries. Now that we're closing in on the actual election, as you mentioned when recording this, we're a little less than 3 weeks away. Has the Trump phenomenon and the Trump campaign surprised you with regards to how its rhetoric has evolved during this campaign?
Well, I mean, who hasn't been taken by surprise, right? I'm as alarmed as anyone at how swiftly Trump appears to have corrupted the norms of civility that used to be observed in U.S. presidential races. But, I think there have also been positive signs on display. The pushback against Trump's hate-mongering by media, civil society, ordinary citizens, and even his own party, I don't think has been negligible by any means. And I think there's still a lot the world can learn from how Americans have risen to the Trump challenge. So in contrast, in the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi, who was much more a formidable exponent of hate spin than Trump, Modi was given a much easier ride by India's political establishment and the media. So if indeed Trump loses, as it now appears that he will, I think it's going to be a long time before the U.S. Sort of repairs the political culture that it took pride in, the culture of civility in public discourse, more or less. But I think compared with what's happening in some other open societies, I think at least the Americans have shown that it is possible, without recourse to the force of law, it is possible for civic groups, media, ordinary citizens to push back firmly.
So earlier in this interview, you talked about that you could have also talked about Europe. And I know that there's been a strong resurgence of right-wing politics in Europe, particularly after the 2015 entrance of Syrian and Iraqi refugees into Europe. Now, you didn't talk about it in the book, but is there anything in particular you're watching in Europe with regards to the same topic of hate spin?
Well, there are various approaches to the balance between religion and politics that are being tried in Europe. Some are closer to the American model. Some, like France, is very different. From what I've seen so far, I think The French case is a good example of what not to do. Because one thing that I am quite convinced about is that, look, religion can't be categorized as the problem. You know, then the answer isn't to gravitate towards some kind of secular fundamentalism where you declare all kinds of religious expression to be incompatible with democracy. That is just not empirically true. And there's no reason why religion cannot have a role in public, let alone private life. When you do try to take this hard line against religious expression of any kind, inevitably, this ends up being discriminatory, as you're seeing in France and some other European countries, because what happens is that the religion of the majority, which tends to be seeped into the general culture and no longer seen even as religious, gets a free pass, and unfamiliar religions, basically the religions of new immigrants and other minorities, are penalized. The American approach I find far superior, which is to put first and foremost religious equality as a fundamental principle. And I think one of the learning points for me looking at these various cases around the world is that maybe we should not even be that focused on speech, you know, what people say, how offensive it is, because if you can instead focus on anti-discrimination, if you can guarantee religious liberty, the right to express one's faith, much of the problem of offense is taken care of. Arguably, most of the reaction against things like caricatures of the Prophet Muhammad in Europe and so on, they have on the surface been reactions against expression. But of course, we know that they are also a symptom of a sense of discrimination, of real discrimination faced by immigrants, in particular Muslim immigrants.
Cherian George, the author of Hate Spin, the Manufacture of Religious Offense and Its Threat to Democracy. Thanks for being on the MIT Press podcast today.
Thank you.
For more information about this and other titles, please visit our website at mitpress.mit.edu. Don't forget the MIT Press can be found on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Pinterest. Thank you for listening to this episode of the MIT Press podcast. Copyright 2016, the MIT Press, all rights reserved.